Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. This week we are focusing on all things EdTech. What do teachers, parents and pupils need to know about technology in the classroom? We'll hear from Kira Riley of Marino Institute about embracing technology and how to do it right. Plus, we'll learn more about Microsoft DreamSpace. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. We're going to start with Kira Riley, Assistant Lecturer and Lecturer in Education and Digital Education at the Marino Institute of Education here in Dublin. Kira, I know that you've been working in this field for some time now, and it's never been as hot or as relevant as it is at this moment in time. Before we talk through sort of different scenarios and even different devices, is there a digital education policy that kind of blankets and covers every single school?
Yes. So since 2017, we have the Digital Learning Framework in Ireland. This was a key action policy approach that stemmed from a goal in the Digital Strategy for Schools 2015-2020. So this is the approach and the planning framework for both primary and post-primary schools in Ireland. And in it, and indeed people who are listening might be interested to have a look at the plan and what's contained in it. There's an excellent website that explores the parameter of the framework on dlplanning.ie. And you see, when you look at the architecture and approach of it, it looks at teaching and learning and leadership and management approaches when it comes to using digital technologies in education. So that's for the school side of things. And it's there. And in theory, every school should have a digital learning plan where you follow a 6-step planning approach, where you select elements of the framework to improve your ability in some way. So as I say, it could be within teaching and learning or leadership and management.
And for this policy to be in place, does that mean that there's a specific budget allocated to the digital learning side of things?
Okay, so when it comes to the funding, as part of the implementation of the Digital Strategy for Schools, funding of 210 million was set out to fund the ICT infrastructure in this space over the 5 years of the strategy. And on average, like every year, it's been an amount of 50 million that has been released to schools, but on a per capita basis. Now, this year, actually, it was kind of a little bit different. They released 40 million automatically. So it was all schools were eligible for this grant payment. And they had ring-fenced 10 million in funding for schools to assist them in the continuity of learning because of the COVID-19 closures. But how it works is, in theory, it sounds like a lot of money. It's a per capita amount that is quite small. So when you break down the figures, say if you take a mainstream pupil in a mainstream primary school, this year's payment amounted to €30.75 per pupil.
Oh my gosh.
Now that was, yeah, very, very small amounts. Now it does go up for post-primary. There is a disparity there. You get more at post-primary level. So say a mainstream pupil in a mainstream post-primary school would get just under €44 for them. And then you get, say, a little bit more if you have a DESH status, a designated disadvantaged status for your school, and of course then less for the likes of a fee-paying school. So yeah, I understand when people are frustrated about maybe the lack of progress we're making in this area in education. But people do need to be aware that schools are under huge budgetary pressures to provide for these advances and to address this and to provide for it in the curricular development and approaches in the school, but that the money is very, very tight.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was that tight. When you break it down per pupil and so on, it is very, very small. So you can understand why every kid doesn't have access to an iPad or a tablet or whatever. The distinction between money and policies for digital learning versus devices for all the kids. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine last week and I was saying when I was in secondary school, this isn't that long ago, it was like 2007 or so, I remember my biology teacher, Inni Cahan, she used to write on like see-through plasticky pages and then put them up on an old projector that was older than I was. And that's how we learned our biology. Now, when you step into a classroom, there's all these digital whiteboards. There's a whole host of technology that's going on. Is that where, like, is there sort of a best practice? Should the money go into tools for teachers to use to teach, or should it go into devices for kids to get hands-on with?
So, first of all, I would say I love a bit of acetate myself. Big fan of a projector. I remember sitting in Mrs. Tracy's room in St. Lactans in Freshford, looking up to the ceiling sometimes. It was the only place where you could trap a little bit of dark ceiling space for us to be able to see the projector. And that was how we did our Irish. Where we have progressed from that point, yes. So, like your classic classroom scenario now, at primary level, you're likely to see whiteboards in the majority of rooms. If you don't have a whiteboard that is interactive, you'll at least have a projector, or indeed a visualizer is a great piece of tech where you can, maybe you'll have one copy of a book and you can display it on the board for pupils to see. Now, you also, to talk about like what direction should a school take, it's a big area to look at. Personally speaking, I'm really passionate about getting teachers up and running on platforms. And I'm really interested in how schools are operating on the cloud, for example. Do they have shared platforms in which to work and to collaborate? That, for example, would have been a major benefit to schools during the COVID school closure period if they already had existing spaces on the cloud and teachers were trained to work in this space. So, you know, whatever it is, if you're getting your school, say, for example, set up on G Suite for Education, this is can really transform the way in which teachers work. And I think if you can get through that, the working approach and the working day and how the school approaches working with their employees, their teachers, that it can really help a teacher feel encouraged to experiment more at a teaching and learning level. So I would love to see funding really put into staff, be it through training or, you know, there are some schools where, and people are often really surprised to hear this, where teachers still do not have access to a laptop device of their own. So for work purposes, they are still bringing in their own devices in from the home. And for a number of reasons, but most importantly, you know, fairness and equality, but also from a child safety point of view, that is a red flag for me. I would be really concerned about that. So this is something I would be telling schools to look at. But then you do have the other side of it. If you look at the elements of the digital learning framework, the concept of constructivist learning, where the child is making, creating and doing is key. And you put the tech in their hands so that they're playing an active role in constructing an understanding about the world. That is equally as important. So I don't think you can look at either in isolation. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're planning for school digital plan, you can choose in any one year maybe to put in a key focus on teaching and learning or leadership and management. But an astute and forward-thinking school leader will be looking at both in tandem. And they should have been doing that really before COVID. But my goodness, since the school closure period, all of this area, balancing the teaching and learning and leadership and management approach, has been brought into sharp focus.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the platforms that are there for teachers. So you mentioned the G Suite offering, and I looked at Google Classroom last week. I had a little sniff through it and saw the different elements that are there, how a teacher could use it, how a student would interact with, say, online lessons, online quizzes, that type of thing. Talk us through what that entails.
Okay, so I would describe it as it's your digital classroom, but it's like a digital school bag. So it's the connection between the school and the home, and the child can fluidly move between work that they have completed in school to be accessed at home, or they can upload activities that they have completed at home that they can later access in school. So within, say, the likes of a G Suite, I would say a school should have a staged approach to introducing it. I would start by introducing email, calendar, all of that side of things for teachers first, and then bringing pupils in. People are surprised when you explain to them sometimes that having access to the likes of G Suite, you can control a lot as the teacher. So say, for example, you may want them to have access to Google Classroom, but you do not want them to have access to Gmail. That's absolutely fine. You can customize your approach to it. The likes of Google Classroom and the likes of this space I'm particularly interested in. I think this idea of digital portfolios is becoming more and more important at second level. We see with the new junior cert approach and junior cert reform that concept of like saving your work and accessing it at different times and different stages in your educational attainment is really important. And at primary level, I'm very interested in that space too. But of course, you've other options as well. I mean, Google Classroom would only be just one. There's a suite of resources out there. And I think it's fascinating how since the schools closed that people are so much more aware of the likes of the Seesaw app or the Class Dojo portfolio platform. All of these options are out there. And my thing is that it's up to a school to decide which one is best for them, but we need to assist them to have an experience of looking at what they look like so that they can decide which one would work best for them. You know, you also, of course, have Office 365, probably a little less common, I would say, at primary level. You're more likely to see a post-primary school on that platform. But either way, what we're looking at here is collaboration. We're looking at creativity and we're looking at like criticality when it comes to the use of these tools.
You're listening to Ciara Riley, lecturer in education and digital education in Marino here on News Talk. Ciara, you mentioned there that there's different platforms for different schools. Do you think that the Department of Education should just pick one and we stick it so that's uniform across all the schools, and that way we can then optimise and fine tune the digital offering and how the different curricula work on these different platforms?
Yeah, I would say that during the last couple of months in particular, when schools were maybe rushing to create a presence on these platforms, people were trying to be helpful, but there was an ideas shower and people were drowning in choice. Which is best? Should I do this? Should I do that? There is, I would say, a benefit to just picking a platform and proceeding with it. And it was very interesting, actually, the continuity for schooling document that the Department of Education and Skills issued during the school closure period. It specifically mentioned the use of particular platforms, and these would have been platforms that the excellent professional development service for teachers would have been recommending to teachers in supporting them in their learning and the implementation of these schools through their CPD courses, and whether they be online or face to face. So it did help that there was supports made available to schools, whether you were deciding to go down, say, the Seesaw route, or whether you were going down the Google Classroom route. There was superb online webinars and supports made available to schools. But yeah, it is tricky to find the one that works for you. And yes, removing a certain element of choice would probably help. But at the same time, I think I'm really passionate about teachers working best, and I feel teachers work best when they have a degree of choice and a role in the decision or approach that they're taking with technology. And we know from recent cases, some more high profile than others, of how this is a decision for the whole community to make. And a big part of the digital learning plan formation is that you speak to both students, pupils, then also obviously the teachers, but then it's a really important space here that we bring in parents and the home in this space. Mm-hmm. I would be really interested in getting their opinion rather than dictating this is the one approach we should take.
Yeah, if you are a parent of a child or indeed a teacher, I would love to hear from you. What way does it work in your school? How have you found it? Have you been trained enough? Do you think it's the best thing since sliced bread? Email techtalk@newstalk.com. Ciara, on the point of training, who trains the teachers? Do the teachers go through ongoing digital training when there is a new device to ensure that everyone, regardless of their own digital literacy, can use it to its full extent?
So I suppose in the first instance, when they're training to become teachers, there are modules included at initial teacher education level across all of the teacher training colleges. And then once they get out into the classroom, there is a certain degree of choice there. People might be familiar with local education centres close to them where teachers will attend they will attend courses at a term basis or during the summertime, where they will upskill in particular areas. Now, those courses will either be provided by private groups, companies, or in the first instance, and probably more visibly, by the excellent PDST. So that's the Professional Development Service for Teachers. And they basically, through their technology and education and digital technologies team, they support and promote the integration of digital technologies into teaching and learning and leadership and management in first and second level schools in Ireland. So this comes under the Department of Education and Skills, and they offer a range of supports. It can be in school, where they come in and work with teachers individually, or in small or even larger groups. They do online support, and they do give those face-to-face courses or online courses. They also, of course, what comes in under that space as well would be the superb WebWise team who are based out in DCU, who I know listeners to the show will be really familiar with, because you're always mentioning their great work on digital citizenship and online safety and promoting that space. And then there's also the SchoolNet website and the teachercpd.ie website, providing those online supports for teachers. Now, all of those supports are there, but to a certain degree, it is up to each individual teacher to upskill themselves and make a choice to upskill in particular areas. Now, once a school decides to go on a particular platform or to pursue use of a particular app or something, of course, we would recommend that they would apply for school support from the PDST. And what would happen there is an individual advisor from this team, the digital technologies team, would come and support the school in implementing these tools. And the training part of it is so important. I mean, it's not just a matter of throwing the app out there and it will run. There is this there's a misconception out there, you know, that young people know what they're doing with technology. They're up and away. Sure, you don't need to know. That's wrong. You need to instruct the teacher in how best to apply the use of a tool. And they need direct instruction to interpret the best use of that tool for deployment in the classroom. So yeah, training is really, really important. And I would urge all school leaders to invest in the people, in the teachers, before they bring it into the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes sense. It's the same as whatever your career is. There's no point in having a device or a platform or whatever it is if you're not taught how to use it to its full extent and adapt it to the role that you're trying to achieve. It's the same here in Newstalk. When we're given, you know, a new editing software, for example, it's great and it looks fantastic, but if none of us know how to use it, then it's kind of a waste of time and money. Let's talk briefly about the devices for kids, because this gets a lot of coverage sort of every school year. The debate comes around about the weight of school bags and the cost of school books, and should we all just be iPad schools? When that decision is made, and in schools where there are devices, is it up to the individual teacher to arrange it? Do the teachers go out and buy the devices? Do the parents do it? Is there a blanket rule?
So in theory, everything should be happening centrally through leadership, through the top, and there should be a policy or approach in this area. So when it comes to the purchasing approaches, again, that should come from leadership, and no individual teacher should be paying out of their own pocket to fund for the resourcing in this area. I always give the example that, you know, we wouldn't expect public servants to be buying their own technology for use in work, say in a department at some level. So the fact that so many teachers are bridging the gap and trying to put their own hand in their pocket to ensure their pupils get access to these tools, it's wrong. So it needs to happen from the top. Now, to what degree that happens and how much a school invests in it, it does depend on how leadership and perhaps the board of management feel about deploying technology in that school. So you will see in some schools, people are particularly passionate about the use of technology. It could be at various different levels. They could be really involved in filmmaking, coding or programming. They might have been early adapters, say, to the introduction of, say, a post-primary level computer science at Leaving Cert level, or right down to the primary school who had their junior infants using floor robots such as the little BeeBot robots that are particularly popular at primary level. And ultimately, it kind of stems from maybe a teacher or two having a particular drive or passion in this area and kind of putting it on the agenda of the school. Also, parents can be particularly influential. So if you are likely to have parents who themselves work in this industry and are really ambitious for their children to have an understanding of what is involved in this area and have an exposure to different technologies, that will push them along. And then when you have that drive at community level, be it from the teachers or the parents, you may end up having a case where schools are happy to seek additional funding through sponsorship or through teacher donations or through parent donations or fundraising in some way in the school. And you can then take it to the next level. But I mean, therein lies the you know, we're further emphasizing the digital divide there, because that will be a runner in some schools, but it won't be a runner in another. And that's what the challenge is. It's all about leveling the playing field so that a child, regardless of the school they're in, will have access to the same technology and supports.
Yeah, the digital divide is something that it impacts so many of us in so many different ways. But it is worrying when you think that it starts at school level. And I know it's always down to money, isn't it? Which is the most grim of all things. Kira, we have so many questions from teachers that have arrived in through many different channels, whether it's News Talk, whether it's to the email address, whether it's on Instagram, and they're looking for information. Maybe their school hasn't fully adapted digital thinking to its full extent. What's a good resource for teachers to go to and then bring to their principals if they so wish?
Well, for you yourself, I would recommend that every teacher, in order to keep an eye on this area, particularly at the moment when everything's moving so quickly, it's great to have an online presence yourself. There's a fabulous online education community in Ireland, primarily through Twitter, but through other channels as well, who are always sharing ideas and approaches, and they're very generous in supporting new teachers or teachers who are maybe late adapters to the space and are trying to upskill in this area. So I would get on Twitter and I would keep an eye on following a few key people who use the hashtag EdChatIE. It's a great way of keeping in tune with things yourself. Then if you want to take it up to the next level and look at what's happening in your school and how you're planning and how you're, you know, embracing this area, the dlplanning.ie website is kind of your one-stop shop for everything you need to know about the digital learning framework. It's a really superb website available in Irish and English, which is so important. Not all of these resources are available for both languages, which is really important. And you can get to grips with the process, the six-step process to making a fit-for-purpose digital learning plan for your school. But I would also urge any teacher, if you have not been exposed to or if you have not appreciated the supports of the Professional Development Service for Teachers, I would immediately apply for school support on pdst.ie. And when you go onto that website, you basically pick your areas that you would like support in. So somebody will come to your school and assist you in your use of or implementation of it could be an app, it could be a particular platform, whatever it is you want to do, they work with you on that. And they work with you. It is not like a kigara coming to check what you've been doing. If anything, they nearly prefer when you're starting off and you're beginning that you're very open to learning new processes, new approaches, and it will really help you to get going on your digital learning journey.
Ciara Riley, you are a fountain of knowledge. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk us through all of that. And I have a feeling we'll be hearing from you again very soon as we continue through this very strange pandemic-y time and the reliance on technology comes to the fore. Ciara, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you do have any questions or comments, or you can find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. We're going to continue our focus on EdTech now, and I'm delighted to be joined once again by Amanda Joliffe, who is the DreamSpace lead at Microsoft Ireland. Amanda, you're very welcome back to the show. I have been out with you in Microsoft HQ many times now, looking at you in action, watching you teach and engage with students of all different ages. For those who don't know, though, you might just start by reminding us what exactly DreamSpace is.
So DreamSpace is our STEM education venue here in Microsoft Ireland. And traditionally, we've been bringing two skills a day every single day into the building for an immersive hands-on STEM experience, which is kind of grounded in the 21st century skills like collaboration and creativity and so on, the skills of the future, really. And we opened it with the ambition to engage with 100,000 students in Ireland. So far, we met 27,000 students face to face. And then obviously from March on, we've kind of had to change our approach and kind of go with a virtual approach. And we've engaged with around 15,000 students. So we're doing well. But I suppose kind of apart from the target of reaching every student in Ireland and 100,000 students, we do have kind of a hope that we'll be a catalyst for change back in classrooms too. So kind of the idea would be that students and teachers would see the value of STEM and also the skills I talked about. And that as a result, they would like implement this type of stuff into their day-to-day kind of classroom practice as well, like moving forwards.
Yeah, in the first part of the show, we heard from Ciara Riley, who is a lecturer in education and digital education in Marino. And she kind of gave us a bit of a guide as to what the digital education policies are in Ireland, how teachers and principals go about securing devices and funding for technology in their classrooms, how to use it and so on. With the DreamSpace offering, and with the number of students that you have hoped to target and have already targeted, are you teaching the same thing so that it's almost consistent for every school that comes through your doors or visits one of your virtual lessons?
Yeah, so because of the content that we deliver around STEM, and in particular when we look at things like computer science, the context of the schools are very varied in Ireland. So we do customize it. We survey the group before a session. For example, we're doing virtual sessions at the moment. So we survey the group and we ask them what's available to them in their classroom, and also basically what's their exposure to things like STEM, maker experiences, coding. And then we deliver what we feel will be a really effective session, and that will hopefully excite kids and inspire them about the future and about where STEM could bring them, but that it's been pitched properly and at the level that suits them.
And communication with the teachers is obviously very important from your side as well, to ensure that you get a full understanding of what the kids' level and exposure to technology is, but also hopefully give them something to take away with them so they can continue to embrace this type of learning back in their own classroom.
Exactly. Yeah. So kind of we've done independent research with Maynooth University, and we know from that there's a real appetite from teachers, and also from the home space program we've done from March as well, where we deliver daily webinars. So there is a real appetite out there in schools and from teachers to kind of bring STEM into the classroom, but sometimes they're just not sure about how they can give these offerings out. So what we do is we kind of make sure that first of all, we align them to curriculum for teachers so that they do see the value in them, mm-hmm. and that they know that it's something that not only is going to be hopefully fun and enjoyable for the students, but that will actually work alongside lots of curriculum objectives that they do have.
How do you go about empowering the teachers and ensuring that they have the knowledge or even, you know, a piqued interest to continue this on into the classroom?
Yeah, so we have a DreamSpace virtual experience that we've launched obviously for this year, and that the teacher will engage with us through kind of Microsoft Teams calls and with the classroom. And so obviously in that way, they're kind of seeing how we deliver something, so that they can see that it doesn't have to go really advanced from the beginning, that there's some basic instructions that can be given that already stimulate the kids to think in a certain way about STEM. So that's kind of just like we hope kind of breaks down initial barriers for a teacher. The other thing we launched then was DreamSpace TV. So what we've done with that again is we've developed out a resource that's curriculum aligned. outlined and that we've developed worksheets for the teacher. So again, we're kind of helping hopefully bridge a path into STEM for the teacher, because we know from the research that we've carried out with Maynooth University that once the teacher has seen this kind of stuff in action, that they can then see the impact it had on the student's development and on the student's learning. And then the third one this year, which is probably the most empowering we feel, I think, for the teacher, is we've developed out a DreamSpace teacher community. So we've basically developed lots of resources, including like booklets, video tutorials, student worksheets and stuff. And we've created a community now where teachers can engage with us, deliver these experiences, come back to us if they've any questions. So they're not being thrown in the deep end completely, because they can always come back to us and join our support calls and also ask us through Microsoft Teams questions and so on. But that actually, we're hoping it will empower them and give them enough confidence so that they can deliver everything also independently away from us.
And is this virtual offering open to everyone? Because obviously there's only so many people you can have through the doors of Microsoft and into the physical DreamSpace space because of the building is only so big. So can anyone sign up to this, and how do they go about access?
Yeah, so if you go to our website, dreamspace.ie, you can see all the different offerings. The virtual experiences, yes, like, you know, we do take two schools a day every day, but that still obviously isn't going to be every school in Ireland, which is why this year we felt that we wanted to kind of go above and beyond and do those other two offerings I discussed there. So things like DreamSpace TV with the weekly episodes, and also the DreamSpace teacher package, because they can really be delivered actually no matter what the classroom experience is, as in if it's in person, if it's remote, if it's a hybrid setup. And those packages will work alongside those other models of teaching as well. And anyone can sign up to them. They're completely open and they're for primary and post-primary too.
And the DreamSpace TV is a brilliant idea, because if, and fingers crossed, touch wood and all the rest, that it doesn't happen, but if the schools were to close again, some schools, I think, would be very well equipped to embrace remote learning and digital learning and all the rest. But others may struggle, and some parents may struggle at home as well. Say there's only one device in the house and they need it for work. They may not be able to do all the Zoom calls and everything else that are needed for the school offering. Whereas DreamSpace, if I understand it correctly, can that be watched in somebody's own time, or is it an appointment to tune in?
Yeah, it can be watched. They're weekly episodes. So they went live from September 29th. So episode 2 went live yesterday on the 6th of October. But yeah, anyone can tune in, and they actually sit on our Microsoft Ireland YouTube channel. So they're completely accessible from home as well as from the classroom teacher. And we've set them up in exactly that way so that parents can also engage with this. It doesn't have to be necessarily from the teacher. And we know actually, for some research, that parents were keen to know what curriculum links were for certain activities their children were doing. So again, we've made that very clear with the episodes, that this is what areas of curriculum that this episode is related to, and these are the types of activities then that the kids can do, because again, it's about giving them a hands-on experience through the content we deliver as well.
What's the ambition for this project? Because I've spoken to a number of teachers and principals over the last few months who are just saying that yes, they're eager to do more in the digital education space, but they either don't have the time, they don't have the funding, or they don't have the know-how to try and set it up. So is DreamSpace, you know, could this potentially be the digital curriculum if we do go into that full lockdown again?
I think the digital curriculum is so vast. I'm sure from your other speakers, you'll know that as well. And our focus in Microsoft Ireland and the education team is to kind of help education communities in all aspects of educational technology. But from a DreamSpace point of view, obviously, we're very focused on the kind of STEM offerings and making sure that young people get the exposure to STEM, because we know that, unfortunately, for example, there is a lack of females, for example, that enter STEM. So, and that sometimes is just purely down to they've never had the opportunity. So for us in DreamSpace, it's about giving schools an accessible way to access STEM. And like we mentioned, that from the research, we know there is a hunger there, and probably from people you've spoken to, there is a hunger there, but they just need that support, and they just need to understand, where does this fit in my school and where does this fit in my classroom? And that's why we have a team of teachers here that try and make those that very clear vision of, okay, this is how this works in your curriculum, and this is how it works to help your students for the future.
From your own point of view, within DreamSpace and within Microsoft, it must be a nice kind of fit, because obviously Microsoft are inventing new devices, inventing new platforms, releasing them to the world, and then you get to integrate elements of that into education. It must be a very satisfying sort of 360 experience for yourself.
No, it absolutely is. I think, like, you know, like what drives us is to kind of uncover maybe some ambitions and to maybe let students discover a passion that they didn't know they had by showing them what the future could hold. And, you know, there's the prediction that 85% of the jobs in 2030 don't yet exist, and that, you know, a lot of them will involve technology. So we want young people in here to know kind of what that could look like. So for us, the opportunity to deliver kind of this kind of suite of programs and ensure that they see things like artificial intelligence, that they see mixed reality, but that they also see all the particular ways that STEM could be a part of their future lives is really rewarding, because we feel like, again, we're breaking down maybe some barriers for young people to know what the future could hold.
So for parents in particular listening to this now, if they want to engage with the DreamSpace TV, the episodes that are going out each week, what does the child need? Because again, when I was in DreamSpace, I remember you having me stand in front of this big, huge monitor that scanned my face and used artificial intelligence to see if I was scowly, which I usually am, or smiley, which I rarely am, and it, like, tried to guess my age and all the rest. Obviously, everyone won't have that technology in their home. So if a parent wants to put a kid watching DreamSpace TV, what do they need to have with them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, we've always focused on making this stuff as accessible as possible. So for DreamSpace TV, the first current set of episodes, which are going to be 10 that we launch every week, the first 5 literally just involve recyclable arts and crafts materials, because we're doing maker challenges where we ask the kids to build things, basically. And what we're doing through the maker challenges is we're teaching kind of computational thinking and coding skills, but through just some hands-on challenges. So for example, the first episode is to build a windmill, just to give an example of that. So the first 5 arts and crafts materials, something that you can build stuff with at home, and anything at all around the house, really. And we've made it very open-ended for that reason. And then for the last 5 of this first set of episodes, it is coding, but it's through a browser-based open free platform, MakeCode for Microbit. So again, if they could just be sitting at a computer to do that, that's all they would need. There's no purchasing hardware, there's no logins or payments required or anything. So it really is as accessible as we can make it.
That is fantastic. So the website again is dreamspace.ie if you do want to go on. And again, there's no commitment. You can just go on and have a snoop. You don't have to sign up to anything in any way, shape or form. Final question. Why is this an important project for Microsoft? Because at the end of the day, Microsoft is a business. They have, you know, bottom lines. They want to make a profit. They want to make sales. But this is just putting information out there. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, so I think obviously Microsoft, you know, being in the sector it's in, we're very aware of where technology sits in every industry now. You know, we mentioned the idea that 85% of the jobs in 2030 don't yet exist potentially. So, but we can assume that technology is going to be a part of them, because we already see technology being a part of things like agriculture and finance and so on. So first of all, again, it's about that exposure piece. It's about giving every student in Ireland, we hope, access to know what STEM is about, what careers are about, what's coming down the lines, and how they could hopefully shape the future and create part of these technologies as we move forwards, and make sure they're being used in the right way. And also it's about, again, bridging that gap that we know that there can be, particularly among girls. You know, the research has shown that Microsoft conducted that, you know, they're really interested in technology, and then at around age 11, there's a serious decline. So for us, we've purposely had the DreamSpace program look at that audience as well, to make sure that we open their eyes to what's potentially out there for them, and that hopefully in the future we have a really diverse voice at the table when technologies are evolving and when decisions are being made.
Well, look, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I know that your work is very much appreciated by the kids, by the parents, and indeed by the teachers. Amanda, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thanks, Jess.
Coming up next, Eric Mosley of WorkHuman.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT, and I am delighted to be joined by my next guest once again. His name is Eric Mosley, and he is the CEO and founder of an Irish company called WorkHuman. We have spoken to them many times over the years, and they have just gone from strength to strength. Eric, you are very welcome back to the show. Eric, every time I talk to you, there's been another milestone in the Work Human story. And not only have you kept the business thriving and, you know, outperforming everyone's expectations, you've also written a book over the last little while as well.
Yes, well, the book is being published, Making Work Human, now. But of course, we wrote the majority of the book before the pandemic. And the book is all about, you know, making the workplace more human. And if you do that, you create a much stronger culture, more energized employee base, have higher retention, higher productivity. And after the pandemic happened, a couple of weeks ago, we got the first printed copies. I remember flicking through it, thinking, is it still relevant? Because it looks like the world is just being turned upside down. And the good news, thank God, touch wood, is that it's even more relevant. That in fact, it's as if it was written for a pandemic work from home world. What's happened in the workplace in the last 6 months has just been seismic, just unbelievably an amount of change that's happened in such a short space of time. And it's affected every employee in every company. And if there's ever a time to treat your employees as human beings and have empathy, it's these days.
Yeah, it's interesting because when all this kicked off, I did another show called Future of Work, and it very much looked at the future of work and what was going to happen in all different aspects of our day-to-day lives. And there was a few times during the recording of that show that I was actually thinking about you guys, because I have been to two of your live events over the last number of years. And when I'm there, I was listening to a number of speakers, yourself included, who talked about the importance of valuing your people. And it was never, you know, get them a fancy office and make sure there's free beer on a Friday. It was the say well done. It was the check in with them and see how they're going on. Be empathetic when they have personal issues or when they're not having a great day. And all of those small, very human values seem to be what matters most now as people are adapting to a new way of working.
Yes, the Work Human Cloud was built to primarily allow gratitude and recognition to flow from employee to employee, but also to we have applications in this Work Human Cloud to allow managers and employees to regularly check in with each other and meet, and then others to celebrate the milestones in people's lives. And what we're seeing at the moment is that it's everybody has a core human need to be seen, you know. After our core human needs for things like food and water and oxygen, above that, it's all psychological. And those psychological needs, we have a need for relationships, for connection with other human beings. And then we have a need to feel appreciated, to be seen, to be recognized. If we do good work, somebody should say thank you, or you should feel that there's value in the work that you do. And if you feel that, you're just much more likely to do more of it. So the Work Human Cloud is really about encapsulating all of that and fulfilling those human needs. And I think now more than ever, we're seeing that they're just hugely relevant. You know, there's been a massive, I talk to CHROs of big companies all the time. And what everyone is witnessing is there's a deterioration in basically the mental health of the global workforce. We're seeing higher stress levels in employees. We're seeing isolation and ultimately just loneliness in many employees in their working situations. And so if there's ever a time for people to double down on recognizing that we're all human and we have to recognize each other's unique circumstances, it's now. And employees just respond to that type of investment. You know, if you invest in that kind of empathy, in fulfilling their need to contribute and to become who they want to be and work, if you fulfill those needs and help them with those needs and you make sure they're connected with their colleagues, have real relationships, like a sense of community, they'll have loyalty to you forever because you're getting right to the heart of what they need as human beings.
And you mentioned there about investing in this, and I think that's something that we need to explore a little bit more, because the one-off email going, look, everyone, I know we're in tough times, but you're doing a good job, that's not really sufficient, is it? You need to, this needs to be a consistent thing. It needs to be ingrained into the core values of a company.
Well, that's exactly right. These one-off situations are, you know, a band-aid that's long forgotten. You know, a core human need is that you need it as a human being to survive. You need it, you know, consistently. And it's not just, you know, a one-off event and everybody can just go back to ignoring each other and not recognizing the work that people do. We've seen massive companies. We have customers that are just massive Fortune 500 companies with hundreds of thousands of employees all over the world. And in this pandemic, as an example, they have used our platform to give everyone in the company a recognition award for the work that they've had to do in this work from home crisis. And just recognizing the duress that a lot of the employees have been have worked under. And what they found was the amazing thing was the amount of goodwill that came from the employee base back to the company, back to the senior leaders, was profoundly affected them. And it was almost like a cathartic moment for the entire company where they just recognized the hardship that people are going through. And then we're all able to double down. But you're right, it has to be consistent then. It has to be followed through. It becomes part of the culture to, if somebody works hard, to say thank you or to recognize them, to just genuinely express appreciation for the work that that person has done. Because if you do that consistently, you'll just have much higher levels of productivity. And that's ultimately what obviously all business leaders want.
And I don't want any spoilers for the book now, but if any employers are listening to this at the moment and they have seen the true value of their workforce over the last number of months, but the gratitude element hasn't been instilled in the company from the outset, is it too late for them to bring it in? And how do you ensure that it's not tokenistic and it's not just, you know, an inspirational quote sent every other day?
Yeah. So the book is all about making the workplace more human. And a big part of that is obviously appreciation. But it talks about a framework by which you can build culture in a company. And the framework is, we call it thank, talk and celebrate. And so the thank is obviously, you know, recognition and gratitude expressed between employees. That's the bedrock of kind of positivity and relationship building in a company. Talk is getting employees and managers to regularly check in with each other. And if they do that, routinely, the performance actually goes up. You know, Harvard did this amazing study where they showed that employees who had regular check-ins with their managers outperformed other employees. But the amazing thing was that even if they didn't talk about the work or the business, just having a regular check-in with your manager was enough to lift the productivity and employee satisfaction of those employees. So talk is, in that framework, is about making sure that managers, employees talk about the career that the employee has, about the work that they're doing at that moment, about the priorities that they have, and then just generally giving them feedback on how they're getting on. And then celebrate is about celebrating those human moments. So human moments can be in work. So obviously, if you've hit, you know, for example, 10 years of service in a company, it's worth celebrating. But also outside of work moments, you know, if you get married or you have a baby, these are massive things in your life as an employee. And to pretend that they're not happening in work is not realistic. You know, this old assumption that we can be one person outside of work and one person inside of work has really gone by the wayside. We are just one human being. And if, you know, if we're having our first baby outside of work, to pretend that we're not spending 90% of our time in work thinking about that is ludicrous, mm-hmm. You know. So it's about celebrating that and celebrating that people have these monumental life things that happen to them outside of work. And it should be celebrated. It helps build community. It builds relationships between employees. So the framework in the book, Making Work Human, is this thank, talk and celebrate. And any manager, any company can start to embrace and do work along those three pillars. And if they do that, they'll have a more human workplace and they'll actually thrive compared to their competitors.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about next, was the productivity and the return on investment that comes from appreciating and letting your employees know that they are appreciated. It has been proven. This isn't just, you know, an Oprah Winfrey, you know, outlook and vision for life. This is something that truly does deliver in terms of your bottom line for your business.
Yeah, the research is just overwhelming. In fact, we now have a data science division in WorkHuman, and we have tens of millions of recognition moments that we can analyze from a data science perspective. And we have been able to prove time and time again this amazing increase. But it's not just us. There's, you know, independent companies, there's universities who have produced research. IBM have done some amazing research in this regard as well. And it all shows that when you meet an employee where they are, you know, when you solve for their human core, that they are freer to express themselves, and meaning they're freer to be more creative, they're freer to have a more positive attitude towards work, so the productivity goes up. What's amazing as well about the data around recognition is that you can also then look and see trends and gain insights into how work is accomplished in your company, like who does what and who is valued by the other employees. You can also then go a level deeper and see, do you have any problems in your company? Is there equity, for example, gender equity? Can you predict who is a potential leaver in the company? And then who is mostly retained? You can tell all of that when you have enough data around a recognition program. So the science behind recognition is now very, very deep. And what most companies like LinkedIn, for example, have been able to discover, that there's a certain threshold of recognition that an employee, when they receive that threshold of quantity of recognition, become almost, you know, 98% likely to stay in the company. And that's an amazing thing, you know, to be able to say, you know, I can pick out these employees, I can see how many times they've been recognized by their colleagues, and there's only a 2% chance that they're going to leave. Whereas other people who haven't received recognition have only have a 15% probability of leaving. That's a massive business gain for that company, because they then get to keep the people they want to keep and keep turnover low, which is a huge financial cost for most companies.
Aside from sharing the wisdom in the book, did you enjoy putting this together almost as an opportunity to reflect back on the success? Because I remember talking to you, I think it was in Nashville when we were at WorkHuman Live, and you kind of insinuated that you haven't really had time to catch your breath since you started this company, because the success has been so phenomenal and breathtaking.
Well, it's the nature of the company is that it's all consuming, you know, and it's reinvented. The science moves so fast. The company has grown so fast that there isn't just naturally a time when you can kind of reflect. Even in the last couple of months, I mean, we're, you know, a company with over $500 million in revenue, and yet we've had multiple months in the past 4 or 5 months that have been over 30% growth year over year. And that's just enormous when you're already getting to be a sizable company. And it's because we have become hugely relevant, you know, in this time. Companies have looked to our products and services as a way to help them in this, you know, turbulent world that we have. And so obviously we have to react to that. We have to invest for the future, but we also have to serve that new need and that new reality. And so, of course, that's all consuming. So the pattern of the company has been that it's just become more and more relevant. It's obviously become much, much bigger. much and therefore much more complex. So yeah, there isn't a natural time to sit and look back. I wish there was. I keep thinking it's next year,
yeah.
But it never happens.
Well, look, it might happen next year. But look, thank you so much for giving us your time once again. We wish you every continued success, both the company and indeed the book. It does seem like an ideal manual for businesses going through this weird time, because although this is a nice accompaniment, nobody has written the rule book. A lot of us are making it up as we go along. But as you say, you know, putting the human touch and that level of empathy back in the workplace can only be a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Jess.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on the Newstalk app, on iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Fardy's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.